Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to have some guests later on our show in conversations talking about sports injuries in girls and young women. And we've got a couple faculty from UNC and from University of Connecticut, as well as Cindy Parlow.
Famous
World Olympic and World Cup winning soccer player, coach, and advocate now for sports injury prevention among girls and young athletes. So this is really exciting. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's an important conversation and one that I'm excited to learn about as a mother of a young girl just starting into her athletics. I know you've got a daughter who's right into it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of young women, let's talk about research that matters today. In our very first research article, we're going to be talking about cervical cancer and a lot of times young women and moderate risk of drinking and Alzheimer's.
And we're also going to be talking about depression in athletes, as well as an alternative healing practice to relieve cancer fatigue.
Let's this very first one about cervical cancer screening among women. And we've talked in the last one or two times about the kind of the changing guidelines that really don't require as many women to get as frequent pap smear screening for cervical cancer because of the great job that we've done as society in these changing guidelines. What did they find in this study?
Yeah, well, they looked at, you know, comparing the new guidelines being that if women age 30 or older are screened using pap smears and are HPV, the test for that virus that causes cervical cancer is negative, that they really can go 3 years before the next screening for cervical cancer or pap smear. But this study looked at 600 office-based doctors and sent questionnaires and scenarios to find out when those doctors would bring the patients back.
Yeah, so published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, they found that between two-thirds and maybe three-quarters of the time, the doctors would bring the women back in a year in a scenario in which the women really didn't need to come back for 3 years. So the question really comes, and I think this is a really important take-home point for listeners, is to talk with your provider about, you know, do you really need to be coming back every year, or under what circumstances you do need to come back more than once every 3 years for cervical cancer screening.
And, you know, you may need to come back to the office to talk to your doctor about other medical problems, or there are lots of other prevention things to cover in a physical, but you may not need that specific pap smear. So have that conversation.
And you may not need the HPV test if you're under the age of 30, because even though that's common, it oftentimes goes away before age 30. So again, really, we hope that we maybe can put a link up with our health science librarians about cervical cancer screening guidelines. We'll put a link up there.
That's a great idea.
To a research that matters. What's our very next research?
Okay. Well, this is about drinking alcohol and its association with Alzheimer's disease, something certainly we're all concerned about.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, Christy, we continue to see more research over time that this element of what is called moderate alcohol use, which is usually defined as no more than two drinks for men a day and one for women, compared to zero alcohol use or those who drink more than that, that there are some benefits. This is about the benefits for prevention of Alzheimer's dementia. We already know about the benefits for cardiovascular heart disease.
And in this, they looked at 140 different studies that were done dating all the way back to 1977 and looking at, 365,000 people over time, and found that the moderate drinkers, and as you're saying, that's no more than two drinks a day for men and one for women, were 23% less likely to develop forms of dementia and other thinking impairment. But the people who drank heavily, three to five drinks a day, they actually were at increased risk for dementia. So that was interesting to me, Adam. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that, you know, moderation in almost everything is better than excessive. And we know excessive alcohol use is a host of problems.
Oh, yeah.
And what's interesting is, what is the mechanism behind which a little bit of alcohol may offer some, and probably does offer some protection, according to such research? And we don't know that. And they propose a few things, but it's clearer and clearer that perhaps with a glass of wine a day, if there's no other contraindication, with exercise and education and a proper diet, you really are the things that can lessen your risk of developing dementia. That's good news for a lot of people.
You know, Adam, we're going to be talking about athletes and female athletes and injuries in just a little while. But there is another study looking at athletes and depression.
Yeah, you know, this is so tragic because we think that we're going to have Cindy Parlow on our show today. And, you know, she's a world famous, one of the most recognizable figures in women's soccer history. And yet she had some significant injuries, sports-related injuries, which caused her to give up the game. And here we have more recently some very famous sports athletes in baseball and hockey and football who've committed suicide.
And it really raises the question of, if we are screening children and athletes appropriately for depression, we know it's common in adults and in children and adolescents, and yet maybe in the athlete community or in the sports community, it gets more brushed under the rug. I don't know.
Yeah, I think this we have a way of understanding success and fame as risk-free, and there are consequences to having that fame. And I think it's incumbent upon us, when we're talking to athletes and as parents, when we're counseling our children, to let them know that they may be the captain of a team, or they may be an All-American, but they're not immune to depression. Depression is something that strikes everyone, whether you're rich or poor. Whether you have a job or don't have a job, and whether you're famous or not famous.
That sort of speaks to having a safe community and a safe support system to talk about these things. And perhaps for us in the medical community, as we're talking about concussions and screening for injuries in the body and doing drug testing that schools are doing for athletes, this maybe should be a part of that screening.
Yep. Let's talk about one last research study, Christy. And this is a really interesting one about an alternative practice called biofield healing, and whether that has an impact on cancer-related fatigue.
So let's talk about biofield healing first. What this is a form of touch and energy chelation. I don't fully understand it, to be totally honest, but it somehow helps balance the energy field around the body and draw out toxic substances. At least in the alternative medicine community, this is something that is really thought of as being a way to sort of balance the energy and help people heal.
Right. So with traditional chelation therapy is where frequently there would be intravenous removal of fluids in the attempt to detoxify and to put back in chemical-free. And here this is being done not even with actual touching, but with energy fields here. And what was interesting to Christy and I is this was a study that was actually published in the journal Cancer, a very prestigious journal that had 76 women who had been treated for breast cancer and had chronic fatigue subsequently, and they were randomly assigned to get this biofield healing therapy, or what's called fake therapy, sham therapy, where they didn't have it according to the way it's supposed to be practiced.
And the bottom line is that both groups got better and had some improvements in their
fatigue.
Compared
to the control group that didn't have any treatment.
Right. So the group who received the energy treatment got better. The group who received the sort of sham treatment also had some improvements. And that was more so than the people who didn't have any attempt for healing in that way. I think it's important because there is so much fatigue associated with cancer, and so many of our cancer patients are exploring alternative methods. You know, there's not a lot of risk, as I think about it, to doing this particular type of therapy. But as we look at this, it's not convincing to me that it makes a difference.
I think this is one of those studies, Christy, that I am firmly in the complementary practitioner support, but there's not enough data here. I don't think there's necessarily risk, but it could cost $100 an hour to have a session that works about as well as a sham therapy. And then it also suggests then that people might be practicing sham therapy. And this then falls into what I would call a very strong placebo, which you might say, again, what's the harm in that? And maybe there's not much harm, but in a time in which people are really sensitive and they're vulnerable, I do worry.
Not enough information at this point. So we've had a chance to talk about this alternative treatment for relieving cancer fatigue.
About really having a conversation with your doctor about how frequently you really do need to have pap smears and don't.
About a moderate drinking, potentially reducing the risk of Alzheimer's disease.
No more than two a day in men and no more than one a day in women.
And a little bit about athletes and depression.
Well, that'll conclude Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking about sports injuries in girls and young women with our guest Cindy Parlow and our sports physiologist at UNC in Connecticut. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking about sports injuries in girls and young women. And very excited. This is an important topic that perhaps doesn't really get its due, but with UNC and Duke and all of the universities we have in this region, critically important. And then for all the high schools and all the females that are playing sports.
And we've got some expert guests today, both in their research tracks and in their own personal expertise as athletes. Dr. Lindsay DiStefano, assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at the University of Connecticut.
Welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you.
And Dr. Jonna Register Mihalik, a postdoctoral fellow in the Matthew Gveller Sport-Related Traumatic Brain Injury Research Center.
Welcome, Jonna.
Thank you.
And Cindy Parlow, an Olympic and World Cup winning soccer player, coach, advocate for sports injury prevention, a famous athlete right here in our midst. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we should also say, winner of three NCAA championships with the University of North Carolina. We
go Heels.
Have to put that in there.
It was only two. Three as a coach, two as a player.
Okay. Awesome. Well, we're going to give you credit for every one of them.
All right, great. I'll take it.
Well, you know, this is such an important topic. I've got a daughter now that's in 10th grade, and she's playing year-round sports. And we've got so many friends. We didn't know when we came to this area that sports were so important, but ages 4 and 5, when we first got here, we found all of these girls playing sports, and a lot of them by the ages of 6 and 7 were playing them year-round. Is this something that's new that we then have to worry about injuries, or has this been around for a long time and I just became a parent and found out about it?
For me, what I've seen is that the change has come, not that the kids are starting earlier and playing year-round, but they're focusing on one sport very early in life. And that's the thing that I think that we need to get back to, is letting the kids play multiple sports. And I think it's fine to play sports year-round, and maybe the scientists that are here can agree or disagree with that, but then change the sports as the season goes along.
So what day did you start, Cindy, playing soccer?
I started playing soccer at 3, and then I also played basketball, I played softball, I was on the swim team, I ran. So I did a lot of different sports.
And at what point did you sort of lock in as soccer as your sport?
I chose soccer my sophomore year of high school, so fairly late to when we're asking the kids today what to decide. I mean, it's almost like we're having them decide at 8, 9, and 10 what they want to play for the rest of their life, which I don't think many 8, 9, and 10-year-olds really know that yet.
Well, Jonna, you know, you do sports-related, brain injury research at UNC. And Lindsay, I know you've done a lot of work around knee injuries. Let me ask you both, is this emphasis on pushing young females or encouraging them or inviting them, however one wants to look at it, to really participate in sports year-round, was this an area of research that existed again 10, 15, 20 years ago or not?
I think it probably wasn't. We're really starting to see the importance of, you know, trying to understand what happens when people aren't diversified at a young age, just like Cindy said, that we're asking kids to sort of specify early and what the implications are on development. And that can include brain development if you're playing a sport where you're receiving lots of impacts to your head, because we're starting to learn over time that the more impacts you have over your life, you may have long-term effects. And we don't don't really know how, when kids sustain those impacts at a young age, what that ultimately may do to their overall health and quality of life. And I think Lindsay can really speak to, in terms of development processes and how that might affect their lower extremity injuries in particular.
Well, I guess the other question, and perhaps Lindsay, you can answer this, is, you know, there's growing research of understanding injury with sports altogether, but not a lot of evidence, as I've seen, to really talk about the differences and to understand what's different about being a female athlete.
I'll let Lindsay answer that from a lower extremity standpoint first.
What do you think, Lindsay?
Well, there's a lot on the table there. I definitely agree with what both Cindy and Jonna were saying, and I don't think this was as big of an issue, you know, 10, 15 years ago, like Cindy was saying, because people weren't playing just one sport. I think that's a huge problem. There was a recent article that did talk about possibly higher injury rates with kids who did specialize early on, but that's an area of research that we really need to dig in deeper, because parents all the time are asking about it. And I just think it goes back to, you know, every parent wants their kid to become the next Cindy Parlow and, you know, that next superstar. And so some of that encouragement is happening. But I think from a injury perspective, especially in the lower extremity, the kids who are specializing early, they're losing a lot of the movement training and exposure to, you know, different planes of motion, different ways that the body can move in general when they're specializing in one sport. You know, some sports are better than others at teaching, I think, whole body coordination. But in general, you know, if they're specializing in sports and physical education in our country is going down, they're just not getting as many chances to move their body and just learn how to control their body. It's just simple.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for 1 second, which is, you know, it would appear that you could also make the argument the other way, that, you know, you're playing sports year round, you're more fit, and you're less likely than someone who plays a sport once a year or the recreational athlete. So, I mean, Cindy, I imagine, well, I don't know, when did you start even caring about injuries, or is maybe this is the problem, is that the young athletes don't care about injuries?
I didn't care about injuries until I had my first injury. That was when I started caring. And I think that's part of the problem now, is that we need to educate the kids and we need to educate the parents about what they can do to prevent injuries. Now, obviously, there's some injuries you're not going to prevent no matter what you do, but I think Jonna and Lindsay can both talk to, there's specific things that you can do to help prevent injuries in young athletes.
One question, and following up your comment, Lindsay, about the benefit of multiple sports, is it that you might be able to prevent injuries by developing these different motion skills, you know, moving different ways, cutting different ways? Is that a developmental piece that you think, or is bearing out in the research, that is important to prevent injuries later once you pick a sport?
Quite possibly. You know, it's development of different movement patterns. I mean, think about, you know, a basketball player, you know, versus a softball player. The demands on your body and the way you have to move are very different. So I think it's a combination of, you know, you're not possibly developing certain skills, but then also you run into the whole overuse injury component. So, you know, overall we're seeing for lower extremity injuries like ACL injuries and just chronic knee pain, everything is pointing to the way people move seems to predispose them to an injury.
When we talk about ACL, we're talking about the anterior cruciate ligament, the main ligament that really gives stability to the knee.
Correct.
And I think also in the, you know, we didn't think about brain injury and concussion from a chronic standpoint, you know, even 5 or 6 years ago. And so now when kids are engaged in a sport where they're receiving lots of impacts to their head over and over again, you know, there's a growing body of literature that there may be microtrauma to the brain, and much like there can be microtrauma to every other part of your body. And so that's something that, you know, we also have to consider when people are specializing at such a young age.
So I know we're going to talk in the next segment about the differences between boys and girls, and I really want to get into what we know about that. But you mentioned some tips for prevention. Are there, before we take a break, are there some tips that could pique our listeners of how to help our children prevent injury?
From the coach's perspective, you can teach the players how to protect themselves, whether using their arms, lowering their center of gravity, simple things like that, not going up for a header in soccer when you're not protecting yourself. And then there's also exercises that you can do that Lindsay and Jonna could speak more clearly about.
You know, I think adding to that, things in terms of overall neck strength and body coordination are really important, not only in preventing lower and upper extremity injuries, but also particularly head injuries. If your neck is in better shape and better condition, you can better control your head, which might help to control the acceleration of your brain. But also there's an education piece so that people report injuries and they understand the importance of seeking help for those injuries, which is sometimes hard to relay to girls who really want to be out there and want to really do their best.
And what about you, Lindsay?
You know, everything that Cindy and Jonna were saying, and then also you can't underplay the role of, you know, warming up and cooling down and preparing your body for activity. And through warming up, it goes beyond just the stereotypical jog around the field and, you know, stand in a circle and do static stretching. We're actually showing that, you know, static stretching before activity might actually be detrimental, and it's more important.
Wait,
that you
say,
really
that, say that again. Static, say it again. You went really quickly on that.
Static stretching might actually be
negative. And what do you mean by
negative.
That? What do you mean by static stretching?
So when you're standing, you know, bending down, stretching your hamstrings and just holding it in one place so you're not moving the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
What people stereotypically think about when they say stretching.
And that may not be good.
Correct.
Oh, wow. Well, we're going to have lots to talk about. We're going to need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Lindsay DeStefano, Dr. Jonna Register, Mihalik, and Cindy Parlow-Cohn about sports injuries in girls and young women. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been having an amazing discussion with Dr. Lindsay DeStefano, Dr. Jonna Register, Mihalik, and Cindy Parlow-Cohn about sports injuries in young women and female athletes. And, you know, Cindy, you mentioned you had your first injury. Tell us a little bit about that injury and how you managed to come back and how that interplayed with your future feelings about being injured as an athlete.
I think injuries are the hardest thing in sports. My first injury was when I was 17 years old. I'd just been called in to the full national team for a training camp. In my first training session, I sprained my MCL.
Your medial collateral ligament.
Correct. And so I'm in this environment, and I don't want them to think I'm a wimp or that I can't hang with them. And so I'm trying to play through it. And as anyone knows that's seen anyone with the MCL sprain, you can't. And so to have to sit out and having to even admit that you're injured and then having to sit out from training is just a difficult thing when part of your identity is that you're an athlete and that you play, you perform. And then when that part of your identity is taken away from you, it's very challenging.
And so how do you wrestle with that now as a coach, as you're looking after these young women? How do you advise them on needing to yield to their body when necessary, and also that decision of when you just sort of pull it together and push through? That's a fine line that seems like it takes some maturity to be able to find.
It is a fine line, but I think coaches and adults, we can differentiate between, okay, you need to play through it, that's just a bruise, and then sometimes bruises are worse than they look, too, so you can't always fall back on that. But I think as an adult, you have to help the kid along. If they just have a scratch, okay, you can play through that. but if you see a hard collision, I immediately sub my kid out whether I know that they're hurt or not and check them over, make sure they're fine. But I think as adults, we have to look after the kids, because as a coach, you are the adult in that situation and you have to protect the kids as if they were your own child.
Well, I know that we want to dive a little bit into the two probably most serious or most well-known injuries that I've heard about in female athletes, which are really this exponential or disproportionate ACL, anterior cruciate ligament injury, and concussions. And Lindsay, let me just ask you, in terms of this anterior cruciate ligament injury, I have read these reports about really high numbers in female soccer players approaching perhaps or maybe more than even per number use male football players. And, you know, I have a good friend whose daughter is a senior in college, has ruptured her anterior cruciate ligament twice during high school and extensive rehab. And now after 3 years of not playing college soccer, decided during her senior year to go back playing college soccer. Is that okay?
That's a tough question. It's definitely a tough question. I mean, the occurrence of these re-injuries are definitely common, and, you know, ACL injuries are very common in females, but, you know, they're still happening in males, which I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand or don't appreciate. But regardless, going with sort of what Cindy was saying is that, you know, kids care, especially kids, they care about the present. You know, they care about, are they playing in this game? Are they playing this season? You know, they're not able to sort of appreciate the future. I know when I was a kid and I got hurt, I didn't care how I would feel when I was 30, and everybody would say that. But in and out that I'm approaching that age, I care about it. You know, the rates of osteoarthritis early on after an ACL injury or a lot of other lower extremity injuries, it's alarming, to say the least. So like Cindy was saying, I think we really need to make sure that as parents and coaches and educators that we are stressing to the kids that, yes, the future actually does matter to your body.
Well, and that, I know that's also a difficult situation with head trauma, with concussions, of, you know, loose definitions of what concussions are and the return to play, with the big concern being that second impact syndrome, which can take a child's life. Those decisions, how do you guide people, or what do we know about how long someone should stay out of play after a head trauma?
That's an excellent question. You know, because concussion is often called a silent epidemic, it's really hard for kids to even understand what's happening to them, because many of the signs and symptoms, things like headache, dizziness, you know, trouble concentrating, they have those symptoms sometimes on a daily basis. So when they have those symptoms, it's really hard to know, first of all. And then also they can't, their teammates can't see it. Their coaches can't see it. So it's not like having a bruise or a sprained ankle where you sort of, there's some validation of what's happening to you. So helping them to understand what a concussion is really important. But the most important return to play parameter is that no child be returned to play while they're still experiencing symptoms, and that they then be progressed back, just like we would progress someone back after an ankle injury. We'd never take someone who sprained their ankle and throw them back in, you know, to a game and expect them to sprint without trying to have them, you know, ride a bike, jog, and ease back into their sport. And I think we have to think about that graduated return as well.
What do you say, Cindy?
I can speak about this personally because I actually retired from soccer because of post-concussion syndrome.
What is that? Tell us what that is, our listeners.
So, I mean, there's a lot of different definitions, but my definition, since I'm not a doctor, it's in layman's terms, is you still have symptoms long after you received concussion.
And so the concussion in soccer came from what? What led to you having concussions in soccer? Was it, can you do it from heading the ball? Is that going to give it to you? Or is it when you collide heads when you're both going for the ball?
It's more I would head the ball and someone else would head my head. Uh-huh. So somebody else's head would hit me or hit me in the jaw.
Two heads are both going for the ball at the same time. When your feet go together, you have sore shins. Here, you have sore heads.
Right. And being 5'11", playing in an international game, I was constantly heading the ball, and people were challenging me for those headers.
And so what kind of symptoms were you having that then were persisting so long that you had to stop your sport?
I have a lot of headaches and a lot of jaw pain. So I've been continuously on medication, and I'm so glad that they're educating more people about this, because if I had known, I maybe could have prevented the things that have happened to me. I played through concussions because I didn't know I had one. Obviously, when I was knocked out cold and unconscious, I knew that I'd had a concussion. But there's a lot of small concussions that I had that, looking back at the definitions of a concussion, as a 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old, I didn't understand that.
Well, I know that Christy and I did some research and that we saw in the news recently. And maybe, Johnny, you can comment on this, but we saw that people who've had concussions frequently, yes, we know that their cognition may not be as strong for a while, but that also they're more likely to have other injuries. That maybe their reaction time. And I think you've done some research on this.
Yes. Yeah, so with multiple concussions, we see things like a slowed reaction time. They also have issues with their memory. And we're starting to see sometimes long-term balance deficits, motor deficits that can happen. If you think about, you know, how your brain works and everything sort of communicates with each other, even if your cognition is lacking, if you're not able to process things, that's going to slow down your reaction time, or kids' ability to do well in school. You know, kids' ability to even do well at normal activities at home. You can see overall quality of life go downhill from that as well.
So most of what we've talked about applies to boys and girls, young men, young women. But there are some distinctive factors about the hormones in women, the way their pelvises are shaped, other factors that make the girls more likely to have certain injuries than boys. I'm a mother of a young child just starting into her sports, but how do you counsel her based on the evidence that we have of what we need to do differently with our young women athletes?
I think the first thing is that, you know, there are differences between males and females. And I'll let Lindsay speak to sort of the lower extremity issues. But in terms of concussion, females are more likely to seek care in some capacities than males are. So that may be one of the reasons we see differences in males and females. But also, females' bodies are shaped differently. In the same way that that might predispose them to an ACL injury, it can also predispose them to a concussion. They play their sports differently at times. So, making sure that, females are aware of the fact of those things and also playing the game correctly and good technique. And Cindy already mentioned the importance of adults and coaches in mm-hmm. that role, and I think that's extremely important as well.
We're going to actually need to take a break in a second, and for our listeners, before we will do that in a minute or so, that we will have a little bit more interview on behind the scenes here. So feel free, if you really are following and really engaged as Christy and I are, and as parents and as doctors and healthcare providers, this to please follow more of this conversation. But I guess one final thought as a parent, I'm a doctor and a parent. Christy's a doctor and a parent. From each of your perspectives, tell us what your recommendation to us is about how to protect our daughters and our children from these types of injuries. Maybe Lindsay, tell us. Give us one tip each, a take-home point for us.
I think the biggest take-home point is to prepare your body, and that goes for warming up. That goes for teaching just good ways to move, and there's tons of resources that you can look on proper techniques and to really stress that.
Jonna?
I think one of the things as parents is talking to your kids, having an open conversation about that it's acceptable for them to even tell you that it's okay that they've been injured. So it's okay if you're injured to not play, because kids sometimes even think that their parents tell them, you're not going to quit, or I'm not going to have a quitter. And that sometimes means to them, you know, even to play through injury. So having a conversation with your kids and creating an open environment that it's okay to come out of the game if you're truly injured.
Cindy?
And from the coach's perspective, I would say just to create a safe environment where the kid understands that they can come to you if they're feeling, if something feels a little weird. Maybe they don't even know that they're injured, but it just feels a little wrong, that they're comfortable saying, hey, my foot feels strange today. So that safe environment where they know they're not going to be punished if they can't play that day.
Great, great advice. Well, we do need to wrap up this segment. We'll continue this conversation that you can check out on the blog on Behind the Scenes. But certainly want to thank all three of you, Dr. Jonna Register-Mihalik, Cindy Parlow, and Dr. Lindsay DeStefano for being with us today. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. We'll be right back with your health. Please stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. On House Calls today, we're going to spend a few minutes asking and talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you, as a listener, would like for us to address anything on an upcoming show, we want you to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And today, Adam, we've got some great questions about diabetes and osteoporosis and hot tubs and
things that are affecting people at all ages and all sexes. Let's listen to our very first question, Christy, from a listener about diabetes.
I have diabetes too, and I just don't quite understand why it affects so many things, like going blind and losing a limb and all of this. What does it do to cause all this?
Interesting.
Yeah, and
I wonder why we use terms like diabetes, like everyone knows what that means.
I know, and it's really and it's hard for us to explain in just a few seconds on the air. But when you have diabetes and your blood sugar is higher in your blood than it should be for lots of reasons, that sugar or glucose that's floating in your blood gets to your different organs. And those cells in those organs, like your heart and your eyes and your kidneys, get damaged because of it. It's hard for me to, how do you articulate how that blood sugar and sort of coating all those cells
in
it damage it?
Well, no, what I say is that what happens is the blood vessels over time are much more fragile. They become damaged, and particularly those small blood vessels. So the small blood vessels in your eyes and your heart and your kidneys and your brain, they all get to be real fragile. And when those blood vessels get fragile, they can break, and then they can be leaky, and then they can bleed, and you can have strokes and heart attacks and kidney failure and blindness.
And that also explains why when you have diabetes, we like for your blood pressure to be even lower, because the damage caused by the higher blood pressure to those vessels, when you have diabetes and there's damage from all that blood sugar, the blood pressure can damage it even further. So there are lots of things to pay attention to. The good news is that, yes, all these terrible things can happen to your eyes and heart and kidneys and blood vessels. But if you work with your doctor, stay with that doctor, and have a good relationship, take your medicines and follow up closely, most of those things can really, really be improved.
Well, let's listen to our very next house call, actually about osteoporosis. We actually have two questions on osteoporosis, and let's listen to actually both of them, and then we'll comment on them, because they're two different questions, but both dealing with osteoporosis.
If you have osteoporosis, would you suggest that you take Fosamax, because it has such bad side effects?
I just wondered. I am ready to have the IV for a reclass, and I would like to know, what do you think of that?
So we have two different questions here, Christy. One of our listeners wants to know if they would take a medicine called Fosamax because they're worried and they've heard about bad side effects for osteoporosis and osteoporosis, that thinning of the bones. And the other one is about using a medicine called Reclast, which is another medicine used to treat osteoporosis.
Well, I think the big picture answer is that, yes, taking any of the types of these bisphosphonate medicines like Fosamax can help your bone. If you have osteoporosis or thin bones, then taking that medicine will not only make your bones stronger, but reduce the chance of you getting a hip fracture, which, as we all know, is a really, really big deal and can be life-threatening.
You know, and both these medicines, Fosamax, otherwise known as alendronate, and Reclast or zoledronic acid, we have different names. But the big difference in those two medicines is the Reclast is usually given intravenously, and it can be given as little as once a year. And the Fosamax is usually given once a month. And so some people might say, well, goodness, I would like to have that medicine that's only once a year, unless, of course, it's more expensive to have it once a year, or if there are more side effects. And so let's talk a little bit about what we know about side effects of these types of medicines.
Yeah, and just as a little correction, Fosamax is usually once a week and Boniva is once a month. So there are different variations on how often you take those. But with the ones that you take by mouth, a lot of people have problems with sort of acid reflux or burning in their esophagus. And so the advice is to take it when you have 30 minutes to an hour to sit up after taking it, so you have time for your body to sort of digest it.
And most people, if they can, stomach is working fine, they'll take the something, if they are taking something, a bisphosphonate like Fosamax, they'll take it, and they might take some supplemental calcium and vitamin D to ensure that it's absorbed completely. And we don't necessarily recommend an IV intravenous infusion like the Reclast, but perhaps if your stomach wasn't working well or you were having those significant GI side effects, gastrointestinal side effects, you might then be recommendation for the Reclast, or if you have convenience, because it can be done over 15 minutes, as short as 15 minutes once a year.
Well, and I think when you look at any of these medicines, and any medicine you're taking, if you really look at all the different side effects that you can have, they could be pretty significant for most medicines if you look through the whole list. And this one, the GI stuff or the burning and, you know, acid reflux and those sorts of things in your esophagus, those are the most common.
And I've had patients had them, Christy. I know
yeah.
you have too. And so
patients who will not take it because of that.
No. And then the other thing is, though, is that even a single time use of the reclass can cause acute renal failure. There's been
cases, even
one infusion, one out of 5,000 people treated might get this a year. And if you have any sort of, if you're on a diuretic medication or any sort of kidney damage, you really shouldn't take these class of medicines.
So these are complicated answers that Adam and I really can't review quickly on air, but it's a conversation that has to do with your body, your other medical problems, what you can tolerate in terms of those medicines. But the bottom line is if you have osteoporosis, then taking these bisphosphonate medications like Fosamax and some of the others is a really, really good idea.
For a period of time. Because whether you can be off of it after 1 to 5 years, maybe not for the rest of your life. We'll come back to that. We'll revisit this question. Last real question was a very interesting question, Christy, about hot tubs. We talked about thermal therapy as helping some people and athletes. But here a questioner is about a rash that they get from the hot tubs. Let's listen.
Hi, my question is about my hot tub. Every time I get in mine, several hours later, I come out with an itchy rash. My friend said it could be hot tub folliculitis, but my water is very clean. We have a service and they check it regularly. Could I be allergic to the chemicals they use? What else can I do short of giving up my hot tub?
That's a great question. There are so many chemicals that go into the water and into the cleaning of a hot tub, to keep it from getting bacteria like Pseudomonas and other things. But and there are things I think that can be done to reduce that. But Adam, you've got a hot tub, right?
Well, yeah, and we put in bromides and other chemicals to try to really keep the water clean. The problem is it's very easy, and I've developed it. You can develop a chemical sensitivity. So anytime you go in that hot tub, if you've been using those chemicals, you're going to break out in a rash that's going to be really itchy and bothersome for days on end. And so you really have to look to alternative ways. And there's a whole literature about natural ways to clean your hot tub. And, you know, I'm hoping to find some research, Christy, on do they really work as well? Because you don't want to have that contamination. But things like baking soda or vinegar and water, some grapefruit-free seed extracts, some ways to naturally keep that water clean. Maybe our listeners can write in about what they know, and we can find out what research exists.
That's a great idea. Well, we've had a chance to talk briefly about hot tubs and dermatitis.
Osteoporosis and these bisphosphonates.
A little bit about diabetes. And we really appreciate the time that it took for you guys to call in and write into us, and want those of you out there to continue to do that.
Yep. Send us yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us at yourhealthradio.org, Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes, as well as free podcast.
And we want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Lindsay DiStefano, Dr. Jonna Register Mihalik, and of course, Cindy Parlow. We also want to thank Dragonfly Girl Gear for helping us get the show organized. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.